KBVR Corvallis, 88.7 FM. You're listening to P's and Q's, a part of KBVR's The Ministry of Truth.
With me today is Professor Emerson from the Department of Economics. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I just want to start by saying that of all the professors I know here at Oregon State University's Department of Economics, you are by far the happiest and most optimistic. And right now we're going through a recession. I think we need a little optimism. Hopefully that's something that's helpful to us. Can you tell us why you are so optimistic? Is there any reason, or is this just a personality?
Well, I suppose I'm an optimistic person. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm terribly optimistic about the economy.
That's depressing. Now,
I'm smiling when I say it, so.
That's true. I guess the news director for Iraq was smiling too when he said that Iraq was winning the war, when in fact he knew it was not the case. Do you have any good news for us about the economy?
No, there's sort of recent discussions, I think, started by the Fed chairman Ben Bernanke about the green shoots seeing little, and I think Larry Summers said something about little anecdotes, optimistic anecdotes here and there. So there are, there are a few things. The stock market's up. That I don't think is a good indicator of the health of the economy, but it certainly helps those invested in equity funds and is a precondition, I think, for the economy getting on track. But we have lots of instances of the stock market going up that precede recessions, and then we see stock market going back down. It's not a real indication of the recession. But there are, there are a few things. There's some indications that home sales are picking up in response to the lowering of mortgage rates, for example. So I guess I'm cautiously optimistic that by the end of this year, we'll start seeing some of the indicators that are trending negative start to trend positive.
Well, end of the year, so are you saying there's a light at the end of the tunnel for this recession? We can see it?
I think there's a light at the end of the tunnel. I'm anticipating it. I'm not sure I can see it yet. I'm seeing sort of little faint glimmers of light potentially, but I'm not sure what they mean. Could be the end of the tunnel, or it could just be some...
What do you think the economy will look like, or the greater political sphere will look like after this recession? Hmm. Is there going to be a change, do you think?
Well, I think there's likely to be a change in the way the government administers healthcare, for example. I think if you look at long-term budget trends, the big, the elephant in the room is Medicare and healthcare in general, healthcare costs in general. So I think that one of the things that will get accomplished that hasn't been able to be accomplished in the last couple decades is real healthcare reform. And so that's going to really transform the way the government and its people interact.
What do we have to be concerned about the economy today?
We have to be concerned about sort of the same things that we've been worried about for a while, the health of banks. The Fed is apparently delaying the release of the stress testing they're doing, which is basically putting banks through kind of a worst-case scenario and seeing whether they're still solvent in that worst-case scenario, which suggests that there are probably a number of banks that didn't survive the stress test, and they're trying to figure out what's the best way to manage the situation when that news becomes public, because that could really hurt the stock market, for example. Investors are going to flee. So one of the things that we need to worry about is the credit markets in general and the health of banks. The other thing we need to worry about is how far home prices are going to continue to fall. That's actually one area where I'm reasonably optimistic. I think that the government is doing a fair amount to try and shore up home markets without being over-interventionist about it. But that could still cause problems, because that filters through into the bank's balance sheets in terms of the assets on their sheets that are based on the values of homes and the performance of mortgages. So those are two big things to look for. I think there are some positive signs in terms of business investment, but the problem with that is that you can kind of get false positives there, which is businesses that pull back so much in anticipation of a recession may realize, well, we pulled back a little too far, so we'll start reinvesting a little bit, but not nearly where they were before.
Right. And there's a lot of public unrest. I don't know if economists feel this, but there's a lot of anger right now and hatred for banks. Can you perhaps give an explanation for why we need to be worried about their survivability when it seems like the general public is out for blood for these bankers, that we don't like to see them get bailed out. We want to see them suffer in creative and perhaps cruel ways.
Yeah, well, there is a lot of schadenfreude, right? You want to see them, want to see these people who have done so well, and so well based on, you know, some engineering of credit markets that's turned out pretty badly in the
now,
end.
Hold on. I can't say that's schadenfreude. Schadenfreude makes us sound malevolent, where we would prefer to call it justice, poetic justice. Schadenfreude is so German and rough and cool. Please continue.
Call it what you will. But okay, so I agree with that. There's a lot of sort of populist anger about what's going on in terms of banks, and particularly in terms of the people in charge of banks and in charge of these sort of derivative markets that did so well. You know, I can give you just kind of the classic stock answer, which is that you can sort of cut off your nose to spite your face, but you're going to end up suffering for it. So I think it might have been Fed Chairman Bernanke who used the example of, you know, if your neighbor's house is burning because they smoked in bed and you think, well, it serves them right for engaging this risky behavior, it's still not a good idea to let their house burn out of control, because pretty soon the next thing you know is your house is burning. So really what the problem with the credit markets collapsing is that banks play such a vital role in our economy in terms of being a financial intermediary, in terms of directing savings to productive uses, that if we let them fail, the damage to the economy would be really grave. We'd see, you know, a lot of bankruptcies, not only in banks, but then a subsequent round of bankruptcies in terms of businesses and lots of jobs lost, and it would be very hard to recover.
Now, I've never met Ben Bernanke, so I don't trust him, though I have heard him talking about the interview he gave for 60 Minutes where he made that analogy of if your neighbor's house is on fire, you have to put it out before you can punish him for whatever he's done.
He's made that a few times, yeah.
What I haven't heard is the economic explanation for why banks are important. You say that it's important for our businesses.
Sure.
And I'm sure you have models to back this up. Is there even a little bit of doubt in your mind that the banks play a large role? Like, if we don't bail out these financial sectors, perhaps we do need banks, but that we couldn't recover within a short amount of time, that we really need... I guess what I'm trying to say is we really need these banks to succeed. We may need a banking sector, but is it really AIG that has to be the banks or the investment banker? Is it Goldman Sachs? Or can't we let these banks fail and then a new crop of banks will pop up who we don't hate so much?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think there is so there's two things I'll say. The first thing is that the idea that, you know, no bank should fail or all the banks should be preserved in the form they're at is clearly wrong. I mean, we know already that there are some institutions that became too big to fail. The fact that we've had to bail them out suggests perhaps that what we need is a banking sector that's not so concentrated in the hands of a very few banks that can really do damage. So that's the first thing. But getting back to your original point, I am pretty much free of doubt about the role of credit markets. And the problem with letting, just sort of letting, for example, Bank of America and Citicorp fail is it probably won't just stop there. It'll take down lots of other banks. I mean, that would be bad enough because those are such huge banks. But it'll probably take down a whole host of other banks, because as soon as investors see some banks fail, they're going to start pulling their investments out of equity in all kinds of other banks. And the thing about credit markets is that, you know, in the very sort of simple economic explanation is, you know, all the savers in the world create this pool of capital that can either be unproductive, stuffed in mattresses, or it can be put to productive uses. And the role that banks play is exactly finding the most productive uses for that capital. And that's a real key component of economic growth and something that drives our economy.
Along with this anger towards banks, there seems to be growing distrust about the capitalist system. Do you think that the capitalist system failed us here, or is this just a bump in the road towards continual progress?
I think that... So this is how I would describe the market-based capitalist society, if you like, which is that markets have been shown to be very effective ways to distribute resources and are very efficient in doing so. However, we know as economists that there are a lot of instances of market failure. So there's lots of areas in which the government gets involved, public goods they provide, roads and police, and they regulate environmental pollution, for example, because of externalities problems. And this is another case where we traditionally regulate the sector, and our regulation just didn't keep up with the market failures, which have now, you know, evidenced themselves. So we understood that there's problems of moral hazard and problems of adverse selection, for example. But the types of regulations that we put in place in, you know, the 1930s and in response to the Great Depression, the crisis that happened then, really were inadequate. And in fact, there was a little too much faith in markets, because it was exactly people like Larry Summers who, in the 1990s in the Clinton administration, argued for the relaxation of some of these regulations, allowed commercial investment banks to become one, and the kinds of things that have led to this. So I don't think it's a problem with the capitalist system. I think it's the problem with the way that the government regulates these certain markets in ones that are prone to failure like this.
So is it that you're saying that the government regulations have failed us? Would you be comfortable saying that that would be a primary cause for the recession?
Yeah, I would, actually. I think that is the main proximate cause of the recession, because it was exactly those loose regulations that allowed this sort of giant pool of capital that kept flowing into these residential mortgage markets and these derivative securities markets that, you know, it just allowed it to inflate into this gigantic bubble. And it really is the popping of this bubble that has taken us to this point. I will say, however, though, that another aspect of, you know, a capitalist society that is harder to deal with. So we might be able to deal with sort of the immediate government regulation of pollution and public goods and antitrust and kinds of traditional economic sort of day-to-day regulations. But I think what we're not so good at is understanding the long-term effects of government investment in things like education, infrastructure, technology, health. And I think that's one of the things that worries me about sort of the hopefully coming recovery, which is that over the last 20 or 30 years, we've done a pretty bad job of investing in those areas. Those are really long-term. Those have very long-term effects. It's very hard to see the effect immediately of underinvestment in education, for example. But without that kind of investment in education, it's hard to see where the fundamental growth, you know, the drivers of fundamental growth are going to come from.
So explain to me why you think that our current government regulations have underinvested in areas like education.
Well, it's not government regulation, but it's government investment.
So, government investment, yes.
Yeah, so the obvious piece of evidence is that in the United States, we're about to have the first generation that is less well-educated than their parents. And I think that in a world that's increasingly driven by technology and where productivity, is increasingly based on technology and understanding technology, that this is, you know, a very worrying trend. And by the way, the trend in the United States is opposite the trend we're seeing in like East Asian countries and Western European countries. So I think if we're not producing the human capital, the knowledge and the know-how with which to come up with the innovations and new technologies that are going to sort of drive productivity in the future, we're going to end up falling behind.
Is that what you think is going to save us, is education?
Save us from what?
Ooh, that's a good question. That's an economics question. That's why you're a professor. Save us from future recessions, from stagnation, from a Mad Max universe. Any number of scenarios that would be bad.
Okay. Well, so first off, you know, the business cycle is kind of a fact of life. We thought, by the way, this is kind of amusing. For a long time, we were talking about the great moderation that happened since the 1970s. We haven't had big business cycles. We haven't had exactly what we're experiencing now. And so we all decided that it was the great moderation. That was because we became really good economists and we understood the economy really well. Clearly, that's no longer true. There isn't a great moderation. There's still business cycle, and there's always going to be ups and downs. What I'm talking about is more sort of the long-term growth trajectory of the country. I assume what you're implying is some of the sort of resource depletion that you worry about going along with economic growth. And yeah, actually, I think that economic growth and market-based economies are exactly two sources of hope, because as resources become scarce, the price for those resources goes up, and that creates the incentive to create new technologies, to create renewable energy technology based on renewable energy, for example, or more energy efficient, to become better at utilizing resources smartly and polluting less. And to give you a good example, Western Europe, I think if you look at CO2 emissions per capita, I think Western Europe is less than half of what the United States is for, you know, relatively similar income levels. And the reason that Western Europe is so less impactful on environment in terms of carbon emissions is because the price of carbon utilization is so much higher in Europe. And so it's exactly that sort of incentives created through the price system that I think is one of the hopes. And then the other thing we know that as income goes up, so as growth goes up, you start valuing exactly those things like clean air, clean water, forests and parks and things more. And so as you become a wealthier society, we start protecting those resources better. And in fact, it's kind of medium income countries that are going through high growth spurts, kind of like China, for example, that's so hard on its environment. So obviously very simple economies based on, you know, sort of rural agriculture, not very mechanized and not very chemicalized, if you will, isn't very impactful on the environment. And it's sort of that in process of industrialization that tends to be very impactful. So, yeah, so I think that growth is a great hope.
Now, explain to me if this is wrong, but this is something I've picked up just anecdotally, is mm-hmm. that we, the United States, being a wealthy country, are able to protect our natural resources better than China. But isn't it just that we've outsourced these pillaging of the environment to the Chinese so that, you know, we still demand large amounts of consumer goods. It's just now that they don't have to be made in American factories, they can be made in Chinese factories, the pollution stays far away from us. And I don't know the numbers, so I don't know if the total amount of global pollution has actually decreased, but it seems to me that it has not.
That's exactly right. It's in trade, it's known as the pollution haven hypothesis, which is that it's cheaper to pollute in countries where you don't have so much regulation and where there's not as much demand for clean air and clean water. Not that people don't want it, but that the wealth isn't there to sort of pay for it, in a sense. I'm being crude, but so it's definitely true. So actually, I think that it's not just our growth. In fact, has very little to do with our growth in the United States and Western Europe. But it's really the growth that's going to happen in developing countries that's going to be crucial, because if they don't, then we'll just keep seeing that same kind of process by which they end up being the dirty industries all end up in developing countries. It's very harmful to health. It's very harmful to the earth. It's very harmful to the sort of well-being of humankind. So it's exactly growth in developing countries that I think is crucial.
What about the big S word right now, socialism? it's popular on both sides. I think increasingly more, let's not say public Democrats, but people who voted Democrat are interested in pushing us towards a more socialistic government. And people on the right, the Republicans, are using that word as a scare tactic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an opinion on socialism?
Well, I think that there are some instances where we've seen, I think that where it's used the most is in healthcare, in the healthcare debate. And so I think it's a reasonable question to ask, you know, what is the appropriate role of the government in providing for the health care of its people? The proponents of, sort of purely market-based healthcare, which is the United States is probably one of the closest economies to that. What we've seen is that we do, and this is not, you know, this is sort of true in a lot of markets, but what we've seen is that healthcare is sort of increasingly being catered to very wealthy or very expensive alternatives. So in other words, take a step back. So as an economist, if what you're trying to do is sort of increase the health of the average health level, then probably what mostly what you'd concentrate on is sort of basic early intervention healthcare. But in the United States, what we tend to do is to deal with sort of the upper end stuff and stuff where you have lots of high technology and very skilled surgeons, and because people are willing to pay a lot for that in a wealthy society. So I guess what I would say is that the incentives in the market kind of provide a healthcare system that we see now that looks sort of highly unequal, a lot like our income distribution. I think the two go together. What a more government-run or sort of social insurance-based system would look like is probably a lot more basic healthcare being provided across the spectrum of individuals. So, regardless of your wealth, regardless of your income and wealth, you'll get sort of the same level of standard healthcare. And then there are differences, even in countries that have sort of basically a socialized medicine. You can still go to a private provider if you really want, a fancy knee surgery or something like that. So I think so my opinion about it is that I think that it pays off in spades in terms of later life healthcare to provide that basic healthcare to citizens across the board. And I also think it's one of the things, and this is where sort of you become more philosophical or more moral rather than scientific. So that's the scientific explanation. I think it's actually a benefit, pays off. But morally, I think it's also justified, or I think it's imperative that, that a government sort of takes care of its people in terms of basic health and well-being.
Is there a way within the framework of a capitalist system to address these desires for social justice, for equity? I'm taking industrial organization, and it seems to me that something Professor Tremblay stresses is that capitalism does a fairly poor job in comparison to, on the other side of the spectrum, communism. Communism does a much better job of promoting equity, mm-hmm. and that there is a Rawls theory on social justice that out there people do actually demand social justice. They're mm-hmm. just perhaps not aware of it until you do a certain thought experiment, until you to enlighten them that they do actually want this. And when you were talking about education and how we need a more educated workforce, the Department of Economics is the only exception to this, but most professors I've met from other departments, especially English, tend to lean towards socialism. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the U.S. government could see a shift towards socialism outside of just healthcare, but also in other areas of the economy?
Yeah, well, a couple of things just to be very, very clear about what a market-based capitalist economy is and isn't. So what markets are good at is efficiency. Markets are good at creating as much surplus as you can get out of a transaction. And basically, in the very simple story, is that if there is a good that's valuable to people, then all the people who value that good more than it costs to make it are able to buy it, and all the people who can sell the good sell it, and those people all get surplus from that transaction. So that's what markets are good at. Markets have absolutely nothing to do with equity. So a completely efficient distribution of, say, $100 across a population of 100 people is to give one person $100 and everyone else nothing. Another completely efficient optimal distribution, if you will, in terms of Pareto optimality, is to give everybody $1. So the sort of market doesn't distinguish. When we talk about market efficiency and market optimality, that's what we're talking about, just that we've created that $100. And by the way, the inefficient outcome is to, give someone 90 and burn the rest. Mm-hmm. So it's important to distinguish what happens in markets is what we, what happens within markets is what we promote as this great aspect of them, that they efficiently distribute goods and services in a way that makes people better off, or makes society in general as best off as it can be. But the distribution question is an entirely separate extra market condition. So you can go ahead after the market has created that $100, take it from that one person and say, look, I'm going to tax you $99 and give a dollar each to everybody else. So what I'm trying to say is that second part of the of the allocation of those dollars, when I took it from the one person and gave it, doesn't conflict with the market operating. So I don't think there's an inherent conflict between being sensitive to distributive justice and still being a proponent of markets. So I consider myself sort of both. I appreciate the good aspects of markets. I think that sort of as a default or as a first best, markets are a good way to figure out how to distribute scarce goods and resources. But that I also think that distributive justice is important. People have, there's a lot of mixed evidence in terms of whether it's really important in terms of things like growth. So whether we should care if all we care about is growth. But I think most people care about more than that. And again, this is sort of getting into more moral questions. But in other words, you can go ahead and design an income tax system that's heavily progressive. And that has nothing, that's nothing necessarily socialist about that. What you're doing is allowing, putting an income redistribution mechanism on top of a market-based mechanism.
Isn't the fear, though, this is coming from, I guess, the right, the fear of income redistribution is that, well, you said in your example, today you make $100 and then you distribute it, you tax the $100, and you distribute it 99% to the other 100 people. The fear, and I don't know if there's a justification for this, is that in the next period you're not going to make $100 because the person suddenly has lost the incentive to work as hard because the tax is so high.
Right, or the money's not there to invest
right,
because people are using it all in consumption. So, yes, there is some evidence, that the general lesson, I believe, is that, the marginal effects of this type of redistribution or, for example, let's just use taxing the highest income bracket 45% rather than 39% or something like that tends to be pretty low. We don't see a big, huge differential in investment, for example. And people who've looked at these kinds of distribution questions and subsequent growth have found a fairly weak link between income redistribution and growth. So yeah, theoretically that's a concern. You worry about incentives, you worry about distortions always. But in general, we haven't seen really strong evidence for that. So what I would say, just as sort of a throwaway line, is that I think you can always go too far. That I don't think having a completely equal income distribution is necessarily the goal. I think what should probably be the goal is to make sure we're dealing with poverty and all the aspects of poverty. So making sure that we ensure for the basic health and welfare of the lowest income individuals.
Is there anything you want to say that will give us hope, optimism? You are still smiling. It's been 25 minutes we've been discussing economics. I feel like you have a message of hope to our president.
Economic cycles are cycles, so we are going to come out of this. And for those of you who are, in the middle of your education, you're probably actually timing it pretty well. For the seniors, you might have to see a job market that's down for a year or two. But, for those people in there, I think by the time you're out, we'll start seeing some fairly robust growth. And in general, when we've seen sharp downturns like we see now, we've seen pretty sharp recovery. And so hopefully that's what we'll start experiencing probably next year. And so by the time that a lot of your listeners are graduating, then they can expect hopefully a good job market.
You've been listening to P's and Q's. My guest with me today was Professor Emerson from Oregon State University's Department of Economics. Thank you, Professor, for coming in. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for the Man Bots.